This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to Beyond the Ballot Box with me, Dashrin Johan. Last Thursday, UMNO made the decision to announce incumbent Prime Minister Dato' Sri Ismail Sabri Yaakob as the party's Prime Minister candidate for GE15. Now, this announcement certainly came as a surprise, as many expected Mohamed Hassan, more commonly known as Tok Mat, or perhaps even party president Ahmad Zahid Hamidi, to be named instead. But what does the naming of Ismail Sabri as Prime Minister candidate mean for UMNO? And does it tell us anything about when GE15 could potentially be held? Joining me on the show today to discuss this is Dr. O. A. San. He's a senior fellow at the Singapore Institute of International Affairs. Welcome to the show, A. San.
Hi, very nice to talk to all of you.
All right, A. San. Overall thoughts first. What does UMNO's decision to name Ismail Sabri as the Prime Minister candidate signal? And was it something that you expected?
Well, I think this is once again the mainstream faction of UMNO, namely the faction headed by Ahmad Zahid, as well as Najib Razak, trying to once again force the hand of Ismail Sabri in calling for a general election soonest. Because I think over the past, shall we say, half a year or so, the mainstream faction, they engineered quite a number of state elections in Malacca and in Johor. And the main aim for these state elections was, of course, to make sure that UMNO win big. And indeed, UMNO won overwhelmingly in both Malacca and Johor. That's right. And thereby used that as an instigation to urge Ismail Sabri to call for a general election as soon as possible, instead of waiting till, for example, the middle of next year. But when they saw that these were not quite successful, these victories in Johor, in Malacca, were not quite successful in forcing Ismail Sabri's hand. So this is like a fundamental push, namely, at least at this point, I would say you are our prime ministerial candidate. You'll be leading the charge into this election and so on, at least nominally. And so then you should have no excuse in not calling for general election anymore, because why were you resisting all this time? That's mainly because you were afraid that you might not become prime minister after the general election. So now, well, you will have to call for it as soon as possible. Namely, I think in this case, after the expiry of the memorandum of understanding between the Pakatan Harapan and Ismail Sabri. Yeah.
I want to make it clear that UMNO themselves did not say that they are naming Ismail Sabri as the candidate, as their prime minister candidate, to trigger a general elections. These are just various reasons and situations and speculations and educated guesses to look at the bigger picture of the situation. Now, you mentioned the mainstream faction, some call them the court cluster and so on and so forth. You know, we've talked about in the past how there are different camps in UMNO and they have opposing interests. And we are talking about the mainstream faction led by Ahmad Zahid Hamidi versus the cabinet or minister faction, which consists of the likes of Ismail Sabri and Khairi Jamaluddin and so on and so forth. Can you perhaps explain why, the mainstream faction wants GE15 sooner rather than later, while the minister cluster those that are in ministry right now, they want GE15 later rather than sooner?
Well, this is, of course, a very delicate interplay between UMNO's greater political aspirations, as well as, of course, the more, shall we say, parochial interests of, for example, the mainstream factions, or indeed any other faction within UMNO. It's a very delicate dance or interplay between the two. On the one hand, I think most in UMNO, regardless of which faction you belong to, I think they are quite confident that they could win quite overwhelmingly in the next general election, perhaps not exactly winning more than half the parliamentary seats, but perhaps quite close to it. And thereby, they will find a very junior or minor coalition partner, and they could form a new government whereby UMNO would be firmly in charge, unlike now where you still have to give in to, for example, Perikatan or Bersatu, and even a little bit to Pakatan, because Pakatan is supporting this government, right?
Right.
So it could revert back to what it did before 2018, namely UMNO would decide all, right? So this is the larger picture. But then, of course, the different factions in UMNO, for example, the mainstream faction, as you also alluded to, alluded to, they are anxious to solve their legal concerns, to put it politely, expeditiously, right?
Right.
And thereby sort of restoring their political legitimacy so that they could once again be at the front stage, leading UMNO and by extension leading the government and the country again. So that is their main interest. But Ismail Sabri and his ministerial cohort, shall we say, they are not very eager to see that. Because why? Because they were rather junior within UMNO. You look at people like Ismail, you look at people like Khairy, and Hisham is the most senior among them, but all others are very junior. Imagine if this, the major figures in the mainstream factions, the Zahids and the Najib, were to make stunning and open comeback, then of course they will be again relegated back to their junior positions, right? Mm-hmm. So of course they are not very eager to see the comeback of the main figures in the mainstream faction, and they would like to sort of hold on for as long as possible, so that in the meantime, they could also groom their own supports, nurture their power base, and so on. So there is sort of a clash of respective interests within UMNO, shall we say, versus, of course, the overall interests of UMNO. Yeah.
Would you credit the political instability right now that we're seeing and we have been seeing over the past couple of years due to this, the fact that within the major mainstream Malay-centric parties, we are talking about, let's say, UMNO, we are talking about Bersatu, the key figures in these combined forces the higher ups in these combined forces aren't becoming the prime minister, because Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin, before he became prime minister, nobody would have, ever considered him to be a prime minister candidate. He kind of, became prime minister. A lot of it was due to because of Lanka Sheraton, and they just needed sort of a compromise figure. And Bersatu wasn't the biggest faction among the combine of Bersatu, UMNO, and PAS, and so on and so forth. Although they weren't the biggest faction with the most number of candidates in parliament, Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin became the prime minister. And then now you have Ismail Sabri, who also, in a traditional sense, a pre-Lanka Sheraton sense, would have not been anywhere close to becoming a prime minister candidate, right? Because traditionally, UMNO is always their president becomes prime minister candidate, and that's how they sort of, groom their young people, and then they rise up the ranks within the party. And then once you become the party president, then you become the prime minister candidate. Is the fact that, everything, as they say, is tunggang tebale in that sense, where the younger ones and the lesser known names are becoming prime minister candidates and so on and so forth. Would you credit a lot of the political instability to that?
Well, if you use some baseball terms or something, you would say it is almost like a wide open field, right? And
right.
It's everybody for himself or herself, right? So because, after Sheraton move, if the likes of, let's say, Muhyiddin Yassin and Ismail Sabri could be prime minister, then there'll be those, ambitious political aspirants who would say, why not me, right? I would look more qualified than either of them, for example, at least in their own not-so-humble thinking.
Right.
But I think the year 2018 signals what we thought was a move away from racial politics into Malaysia's, shall we say, more mature politics based on policy making and so on. But of course, the Sheraton move saw a wholesale reversion back to not only racial politics. I think it's almost, I would call it a tribalistic politics because, it's not just about one race against each other and so on. It's a different tribes within a certain governmental cohort trying to stake out each other's interests and territories and so on, or power bases. So you see nowadays, of course, the internal power struggle within UMNO is larger than life. But let us not forget, right after the Sheraton move, it was within Bersatu, Dr. Mahathir and Muhyiddin Yassin fighting it out over who should control Bersatu. That went on for about half a year, shall we say. Then then there was this thing about this power struggle between UMNO and Bersatu, right? When UMNO threatened to pull out of the government and so on.
Right.
And when UMNO, at least the mainstream faction at UMNO, was successful in pulling down the Muhyiddin government and installing what they thought was a compromise figure from within UMNO, very soon they found that they didn't quite like Ismail Sabri as well. So again, you have an eruption of power struggle within UMNO. So from Bersatu power struggle to UMNO Bersatu power struggle, and now UMNO internal power struggle.
Right.
So that's why I would call it rather tribalistic. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there a potential for a bait and switch here? Because when we look at the previous Johor state elections, incumbent CM Dato Sri Hasni Mohamad was presented as UMNO Barisan Nasional's party poster boy. He was their CM candidate, and that was the general assumption that many people had, that if Barisan Nasional win, Dato Sri Hasni will be the CM candidate. And for all intents and purposes, many people, even people on the Pakatan Harapan side and all, have come to say that, and even the general Johorians, they say that, whether we like the party, we don't like the party, or whatever it may be, Dato Sri Hasni is a pretty decent chief minister. And that seemed to be, like, a lot of people were saying these things. But yet, after Barisan Nasional won the Johor State elections, Machap Assemblyman Dato On Hafiz Ghazi became Menteri Besar. Do you see a sort of similar situation repeating itself, in the sense that, yes, Ismail Sabri is the poster boy, and now they say, yes, he's going to be the prime minister candidate, but after elections, assuming that UMNO Barisan Nasional wins, they just switch and they put someone else as the prime minister candidate? Is that a possibility?
Ismail Sabri is indeed in a, shall we say, a catch-22 situation at the moment. On the one hand, of course, as we said, his hand is forced, right? Because the UMNO leadership say, well, we are now putting you out as the poster boy, as the one who should lead the party into the general election and so on. So there's no more excuse for you to delay the election, right? But on the other hand, as you also strongly hinted just now, and as we say in Chinese, after you cross the river, you can do anything you like, right? So at the moment, before we cross the electoral river, you are supposed to lead us across it. Afterwards, it doesn't mean that we would still like you to lead us, right? I mean, there could be 1,001 reasons, the shall we say, the reinvigorated or the newly victorious UMNO senior leadership after the general election could employ in order to unseat Ismail Sabri. I mean, a simple reason I could think of is simply, oh, we the senior ones would really like you to continue. Oh, but you see all these newly elected members of parliaments, they didn't quite like you, right? So, oh, unfortunately, we had to, you know, find another figure, maybe one right. among us to replace you. That could be one of the simplest reasons. But, you know, all these are part and parcel. I mean, part of the 1,001 reasons that they could use to not actually having him as a prime minister. But more fundamentally, I think he is also partly to be blamed. You mentioned also, for example, the Johor Menteri Besar, who was widely perceived, even though he served for a very short period of time, I think maybe not even a year, or maybe slightly more mm-hmm. than a year, as MB. He is widely regarded not only by UMNO, but even by the opposition as being very efficient, effective, and well-liked, and so on, right?
Right.
Unfortunately, the same thing could not be said about Ismail Sabri. Nobody realistically, whether in his own party or beyond, think that you know, he is one of the most capable prime minister who has ever occupied that office, to put it very politely. And right. thereby, you know, he is even easier than Husni to be just sort of you know, displaced by another candidate to the prime ministerial candidate to the liking of UMNO's mainstream faction.
Is Ismail Sabri popular among the masses? When you go on the ground, when you talk to people, when you do your research, do you think he's a popular prime minister so far? And I'm wondering, you know, will Ismail Sabri, as the poster boy, boost UMNO's chances at elections, kill their chances at winning elections, or does it not make a difference? Because ultimately, in Malaysia, most people vote based on logo and not necessarily the prime minister candidate.
It is, I think, a very tall order to even make Ismail Sabri known among many people. This is actually quite interesting, because you would think somebody from UMNO would be rather well-known and well-accepted in the rural areas, right?
Right.
And maybe in the urban areas, you know, they would prefer the opposition, the Pakatan Harapans, and so on. Well, if you go down to the rural areas in Malaysia, I don't think many people even know of Ismail Sabri. There were people who still think Muhyiddin was the prime minister, because Muhyiddin at least make the rounds more frequent than Ismail Sabri. So I don't think it's even a question of whether he's well-liked or disliked. It's a question of making him known. I think that remains a challenge. And of course, the urban folks would most of them still prefer the Pakatan and various opposition parties and so on. So Ismail Sabri, I mean, on the larger picture, it's sort of harmless to UMNO, shall we say, because, as you also say, a party affiliation or identification with party logos and so on would go a long way in Malaysian electoral politics. But he certainly doesn't add to UMNO's electoral chances in the general election.
On the show with me today is Dr. Oh A. San. He's a senior fellow at the Singapore Institute of International Affairs. After the break, I asked him if Ismail Sabri has strong grassroots support within UMNO. Keep it here on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashan Johan, and on the show with me today is Dr. Oh A. San. He's a senior fellow at the Singapore Institute of International Affairs. And we're talking about UMNO's announcement of Ismail Sabri as your prime minister candidate for GE15. So, A. San, what do you think of Ismail Sabri's performance as the prime minister candidate so far? Because perhaps, you know, he may not be this very out there, you know, putting himself out there the way, let's say, Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin did, and the whole ABBA angle. There was a sort of marketing, a branding around Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin that Ismail Sabri does not necessarily have. But when we compare, let's say, cabinet performances during Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin's time, you had that, you know, the widely panned Dr. Adam Baba as a health minister, whereas now you have Khairi Jamaluddin, and he's generally widely liked by the people. Ismail Sabri is also the first prime minister in the history of Malaysia to sign the you know, historic, you know, whether we like the MOU or not, it is a historic memorandum of understanding with the opposition. No prime minister before that has done it. So what do you think actually is the problem with Ismail Sabri? Is it a performance, or is it a marketing, branding sort of issue?
Well, of course, nowadays, politics across the political spectrum is very much sort of enveloped or wrapped up with marketing, right? Or at least public relations and so on. You see, Malaysia is not just an unimportant country around the world. In terms of trade, for example, I think our trade volumes is one of the world's top 20 trading countries. And thereby, Malaysia would have to have a leader who is widely perceived to be very capable, who is widely perceived to be able to, in a sense, even shape some of the regional, if not world, opinion. Dr. Mahathir was such a figure. And his nemesis, namely Najib Razak, whether we like him or not, was also a similar figure, both widely perceived to be very professionally capable and being able to make Malaysia stand on the world's maps and so on. But Ismail Sabri, it's like almost like an invisible prime minister. It's as if the whole country is running on autopilot. And the Khairis and the other senior bureaucrats and technocrats, they are like the computer program which is flying this particular airplane. And a country as important as Malaysia could not continue to fly on the on autopilot. At some point, it would have to land, and hopefully it's not a very hard landing.
You know, we talk about Ismail Sabri among the masses. What about within UMNO itself? Because we know, you know, you've talked in the past, other experts have talked in the past about the importance of having grassroots support. You know, without grassroots support, you cannot last long. You may, you know, get to the top due to luck, due to some smart strategies, due to things falling in the right place. But ultimately, to sustain yourself, you need a strong grassroots support. Otherwise, there will always be this sort of instability. Where does Ismail Sabri rank within UMNO in terms of popularity? Has his grassroots support increased after becoming prime minister?
Well, some of us may or may not like or may not ideologically identify with UMNO's, shall we say, racialist appeal to politics, right? But we could not deny the fact that UMNO, at least in its internal party structure, is actually a very democratic party. Right. You want to be UMNO's leader, you would have to indeed have, as you say, a lot of grassroots support, namely the normal UMNO party members, the various branches, the various divisions and so on would support you to be their leader. So that means you have to really, shall we say, go to the ground a lot. You need to entertain a lot of these divisional and branch leaders and so on. Unfortunately, I think Ismail Sabri, even though he might have done a lot of this, but he simply did not inspire a lot of support for himself in the party to the same level as, let's say, the party president Ahmad Zahid Hamidi, as well as some other the senior minister, which is, of course, Najib. Of course, being the prime minister would help a bit because, well, now you are supposed to run the country. You are supposed to be able to put the various resources and forces in the country to be at your disposal politically, right?
Right.
Since he took over, you simply do not see that kind of search of support for him within UMNO. Most UMNO leaders, from both rank and files to the most senior ones, for example, the supreme councillors and so on, their loyalty still lies primarily and almost exclusively with the mainstream faction of UMNO, whom they consider will be able to bring the party to greater electoral heights. Yeah.
Right. Just now, I brought up the historic memorandum of understanding. Now, in the MOU, it states that parliament will not be dissolved until the 31st of July at minimum. And that's when the MOU expires. Now, it seems like right now, at least in this moment, because things are very fluid in Malaysia, but at least in this moment, it seems that all parties are in somewhat agreement that MOU should be fulfilled. The question is, what happens after the 31st? What have you heard, Ehsan? What do you think is going to happen after the 31st?
Well, of course, the UMNO mainstream faction would like to have to see Parliament dissolve on the 1st of August, right?
Right.
But as we said, Ismail Sabri is not in a hurry. I think Muhyiddin Yassin is also not in a hurry. And Anwar Ibrahim, I think, pay lip service to having elections soon. But also, I think he and by extension, Pakatan Harapan is certainly not in a hurry to have an election. Because, frankly speaking, they need time to regroup. Bersatu saw a spectacular defeat in two states. They need to somehow revamp themselves. Pakatan Harapan, even though they still retain some seats, but of course they have very scant hope of ever returning to power. And again, you need time to regroup themselves. It's only the mainstream faction of UMNO who is very gung-ho about having election as soon as possible. Yeah.
Right. And what will it mean? Because, Ehsan, we've been talking a lot about the elite level politics. But what will it mean for the rakyat, for the masses, if parliament is dissolved after the 31st of July? And what will it mean for the rakyat if, let's say, a new MOU is penned and elections don't take place until 2023? Will it even affect the rakyat, or are all of this just, limited to elite level politicking, elite level Game of Thrones and whatnot, where the rakyat, their lives just are not affected one way or another?
Well, elite politics, it's of course very prevalent and common in most developing countries, and it's not just Malaysia. Right. The Philippines has its presidential elections coming up, and who is the leading candidate is Bongbong Marcos, right? Son of Ferdinand Marcos, right? So, but of course now, again, we are in sort of an autopilot setting in terms of who is running the economy, who is running the country, whether there's economic development and so on. And I think there is this yearning for some sort of change. After all, most of us as common folks, we change our lifestyles over the past 2 years, right? After the this pandemic, it makes us rethink how we would carry on with our life and livelihoods. Similarly, of course, I think a lot of people are eager for perhaps a different style of governance, and certainly it's not like what it is now, namely essentially no governance whatsoever, and let the country run on its own. Because developing countries, you at some point do need some guidance as to what is the overall direction of how the country wants to develop and so on. And such a vision is currently very lacking. That's why, for example, the so-called return of Rafizi Ramli to potential return of Rafizi to politics, it's somewhat inspiring because he, like Najib and like Dr. Mahathir is perceived to be somebody with a lot of policy saviness and so on. And I think there is a yearning for people like him to be able to one day lead this country, hopefully, to greater heights. Yeah.
Right. How much power do political parties and their presidents hold? And I'm asking not just about UMNO, but across the board, you know, whether it's DAP, whether it's PKR and all of that, right? Because in terms of politics in its purest form, and you know, if you want to be idealistic, we as the people, we vote for a candidate and we expect the candidate who then, you know, may go on to be a minister, may go on to be the prime minister, or may just be an MP in parliament. We expect all of them to be answerable to us, the people, and only us, the people, because we are the ones who voted them in. But from the outside, it seems like while Ismail Sabri holds the most powerful official position in the country, you know, he's essentially like the biggest you know, person who he's supposed to be doing public service to the people, the prime minister, he needs to still hold discussions with UMNO Supreme Council on whether to extend the MOU, whether not to extend, when to hold general elections, or when not to, you know, all these kinds of things. And I'm wondering if that's the same with all the political or all the big mainstream political parties in Malaysia, where although technically we are the ones that elect them in, a lot of the power is still concentrated in, you know, among party presidents, among party top leadership, and so on and so forth.
Well, what you just mentioned is essentially the essence of parliamentary democracy, as opposed to a more presidential style of politics, right?
Right.
In US, when people voted for, let's say, Trump previously, even though he nominally belonged to the Republican Party, he essentially did what he wanted to do, right? And he was very famous for that. He didn't have to listen to the senior leadership of the Republican Party, right? Now, in our style of so-called Westminster's parliamentary democracy, party plays a very important role in politics, and party presidents, or you have more, shall we say, more socialist parties such as DAP, the secretary generals of the party would hold a lot of powers. The most direct power they hold is to nominate the candidates. I mean, when it comes to election time, well, you would like to use the UMNO logo or the BN logo to be a candidate. The UMNO president or the BN president would have to sign a letter, the so-called Watika letter, authorizing you to use the BN or the UMNO logo. And thereby, you better be somebody who is loyal to the party president, or else he can just ditch you in the general election. So, in that sense, even Ismail Sabri himself, for example, if he really make, let's say, Ahmad Zahidi not so happy, Ahmad Zahidi could simply drop him from the candidates list and have somebody else. And I'm sure UMNO will still have stumping victory despite the absence of Ismail Sabri. Yeah.
Right. And is this why there is a lot of pushback as by even civil society, by constitutional lawyers and all, when it comes to the latest the party hopping bill, because initially over the past few weeks they just wanted to table a bill where, you know, even if candidates get sacked by their parties or anything like that, then it will immediately trigger a by-election. So let's say today President, UMNO President Ahmad Zahid Hamidi, let's just say, for example, he's like, I don't like Ismail Sabri anymore, or he feels like, oh, I'm no longer ideologically aligned with Ismail Sabri anymore, or even, oh, I believe Ismail Sabri is not working hard enough. It can be for actual proper reasons as well. He sacks Ismail Sabri, and suddenly the party president has just made the prime minister of the country not an MP anymore. And so that won't just trigger a by-election, it will trigger probably an entire general election and whatnot. Is that why there's a lot of scrutiny over this anti-hopping bill as well?
Well, I will answer in the affirmative. I will say, yes, there is this worry. But I will also tell you, I don't quite agree with this level of worry. Huh? Right. Of course, there's a dilemma. We are facing a dilemma in terms of this party hopping issue. On the one hand, we don't like our elected representatives to switch parties at will, right? And thereby sometimes even toppling government, or they did not quite reflect the ideology when we first elected him or her, right? That is an understandable concern. On the other hand, there's also, shall we say, equally understandable concern if we make it very rigid for elected representatives to switch party, then, as you said, the party president could view very deep and high powers in deciding who can be even the prime minister and so on. And that's not so democratic, right? I understand both sides of the concerns, and I think that's why we have this bill for the anti-party hopping law to be delayed time and again. But I think ultimately the people should decide, right? Ultimately, the people to decide whether this decision by either the candidates to switch party, or the, let's say, the party president to fire this candidate is right or wrong. I think by having by-election, it's a very good compromise. Huh? Whether a candidate switches party, or a party president firing a particular elected representatives and so on, well, then let the people of that particular constituency decide whether they agree with the party's decision in firing this MP, or they prefer to go with the MP as he switches party and so on. So I think by election, it's a very good compromise. Let ultimately the people decide whether they agree with the decision.
Okay, before we wrap this conversation up, Ehsan, would you have some final thoughts or a final message for us?
I think I said this before. Malaysia is indeed going through a very rough and bumpy stretch of its political development. But it is also a very good period for us to draw lessons and experience from how the politics of this country should evolve. You mentioned just now this debate over anti-party hopping bills and laws and so on. You see, it engendered very healthy discussions. Some people would say, oh, the concerns over party yielding too much power overrides the concern of party hopping, and some will have the opposite opinion. I'm of the opinion that let the people decide, right, in a by-election, for example. But all these are very healthy debates as we go about trying to perfect our parliamentary democracy in this country. So let us be more positive about it and trying to take a more proactive part in this debates here.
On that note, thank you so much for joining me today, Ehsan.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Oh Ehsan. He's a senior fellow at the Singapore Institute of International Affairs. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can also check us out on podcasts. We're available on the BFM app, bfm.my, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Dashan Johan, and this has been Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.